Okay, my talk will be mainly theoretical, but actually I will also present some experimental results obtained in the group of Christophe Salomon and Frédéric Chevy on degenerate Fermi gases. And the theory that I will present has been in this theoretical work has been performed in collaboration with Jacopo Caruso, who is now in Santa Barbara, Lincoln Carr, who is now in GILA, and also in collaboration with Jura Shlapnikov from LPTMS, and with Ludovic Prikupenko from LPTL in Jussieu, in Paris. So I will move to the other side, yes. Like that.
Of course,
yes.
The organizer's over there, so be careful.
We have better control.
Okay, a brief outline of the talk. So first, I will remind why the present experiments on fermionic atoms are so interesting. Then I will remind you of a simple model of a fresh bar resonance. Then I will present two models that we plan to use to describe the quantum gases in the strongly interacting regime. And I will discuss the advantages of these two models, one with respect to the other. Then I will present a very crude model, which actually turns out to be sufficient to understand the gross features of the experimental results obtained up to now. And at the end, on a more theoretical point of view, I will present an exact n-body time-dependent solution for the unitary quantum gas in a harmonic potential. So as you know, several groups are performing experiments on fermions. At the UNS, these experiments are performed by Christophe Salomon, and here are the typical experimental parameters of this Salomon's experiment. So at the UNS, they are using lithium-6 atoms, which are fermionic. They have a total spin 1/2 in the ground state. This means that now I will consider the case of spin 1/2 fermions in all the talk. So what they are able to do is to trap the particles in an optical trap created by laser beams. And thanks to evaporative cooling, they are able to reach the quantum degenerate regime. So at the end of evaporation, at the UNS, what they have typically is 10 to the 5 particles in the trap. The typical Fermi wave vector KF is 10 to the 7 meter minus 1, which corresponds to a Fermi temperature on the order of 10 microkelvin. The temperatures achieved in the experiments, the lowest temperatures, are certainly below 0.2 T Fermi. They are not able actually to measure very precisely the temperatures below this value, but they suspect that, at least in some cases, they have temperatures below 0.1 T Fermi. So why are these experiments interesting? Mainly because they can freely adjust the strengths and the sign of the interaction using a fresh bar resonance, which is tuned with a magnetic field. So on one side of the resonance, the scattering length between two particles is positive. In this case, there is a two-body bound state in free space. And what you expect is to get a Bose condensate of dimers, a Bose condensate of these molecules. And this has been observed. On the other side of the fresh bar resonance, the scattering length is negative. In this case, in presence of a Fermi C, you expect to form Cooper pairs. That is a BCS state, which is simply a condensate of pairs. And I can also explore very easily in the experiments the intermediate regime where the scattering length tends to infinity. And the good news with the fermions is that these gases are stable in this strongly interacting regime, Kf modulus of A, much larger than unity. Which doesn't seem for the moment to be the case with bosons. Okay, so what is a Feshbach resonance? I will be short about that. There was a talk of Dima Petrov last week. So when two atoms are getting close by, you can introduce states with a fixed total spin. So you have two potential curves, singlet and triplet, giving the interaction VR12 between two atoms of distance R12. This is the open channel, and this is a closed channel. And those curves are mainly Born-Oppenheimer curves. This means that you have actually a non-adiabatic coupling between them with a strength, let's say with an amplitude that I will call square root of C. And in this red curve, you have a quasi-bound state of energy epsilon B above the dissociation limit of the open channel. Okay, so now when you apply a magnetic field, you shift these two curves, one with respect to the other, since one has a total spin 0 and the other one has a total spin 1. And as a consequence, this energy epsilon B can change. And here you have the scattering length in nanometers for lithium 6 as function of the magnetic field in kilogauss. And this is the location of the Feshbach resonance at a magnetic field B0, which has been measured recently very precisely by Ketterle. This B0 is 820 gauss. So on the left side, you have a very large positive scattering length. On the other side, a very large negative scattering length. So that close to the resonance, you can actually approximate the scattering length by this formula. A is equal to A background multiplied by 1 minus the width of the resonance in B field divided by B minus B0. So what I remind you here is the expression of the T-matrix, or the scattering amplitude more precisely, for two atoms having a relative momentum K such that K multiplied by the true potential range, it's much smaller than unity. What I mean by true potential range is a length associated to these two curves. You see, it's expected to be in the nanometer range. So this condition is basically always satisfied in present experiments. So in this case, the scattering amplitude can be written approximately as minus 1 over minus nu C minus 1. Remember, C was this intensity of coupling between the two curves, plus IK plus h bar squared K squared over 2mc. Nu here is just the effective detuning of the Feshbach resonance. So it's the energy of this quasi-bound state counted above the dissociation limit of the open channel, plus a shift which may be due to the coupling between the two channels. So this effective detuning is 0 when B is equal to B0, when you're right at the resonance. In this case, this term vanishes. C is positive. So once you have this formula, you can map it to the general low K expansion of the denominator of the scattering amplitude in the scattering theory. This is a general expansion. Fk is equal to minus 1 over 1 over A, where A is the scattering length, plus Ik minus 1 half K squared Re, and so on. So you see, I can actually reinterpret this term as being the inverse of the scattering length. So A is minus C over nu. And I can reinterpret this term as one corresponding to an effective range of the potential, because this coefficient Re is called the effective range of the potential. So here, the effective range will be minus h bar squared over mc. It is negative. This is not a problem. So in my talk, I will restrict to the dilute gas regime. So I will assume that the gas is dilute at the scale of the effective range of the potential. I will assume that the effective range of the potential, so Re, is much smaller than both the absolute value of the scattering lengths and 1 over kF, which is basically the mean interparticle spacing in the gas. I have to impose the first inequality because when I form dimers, the relevant length scale of a dimer is A, and I want A to be much larger than Re. Then when these conditions are satisfied, I believe that I can approximate the true interaction potential by a zero range model potential, which will have basically the same scattering amplitude at the considered momentum scale, which is very nice because interactions are characterized then by a single parameter, which is the scattering length. So Dima Petrov last week has explained that this is not the only possible regime. You could have a regime of a gas with effective long-range interaction, in the sense that these two length scales, Kf minus 1 and A, would be much smaller than the effective range of the potential, while remaining much larger than the true range of the potential. Please note that if this inequality was not satisfied, then the system would not be a gas anymore. So now, what is the simplest model that we can take to represent the interaction potential? So here, we would like to solve an n-body problem in a non-perturbative regime, which is slightly different from what has been done up to now, for example, with Bose condensates, where the theory was mainly in a perturbative regime. So I have put two requirements on such a model that we can use. The first requirement is that I should be able to use the hypothesis of thermal equilibrium. That is, I should be able to claim that the density operator of the n particles is proportional to e to the minus beta h, where h is the model Hamiltonian and beta is 1 over kT. Because if I cannot even use this absorption of thermal equilibrium, I will have difficulties in making simple predictions on the state of the gas. On the contrary, if I can use this prescription, then, for example, I can use a quantum Monte Carlo method to sample the thermal equilibrium state in an exact way. So please note that this first condition rules out the true interaction potential. I cannot assume that the state of the gas is given by e to the minus beta h if h contains a true, between quotes, interaction potential between the particles. As you know, the true interaction potential will have many deeply bound states, and I don't want to include these deeply bound states in my theory. I want to describe a metatensible state, which is the one seen in the experiment. Okay, the second requirement is that the model should lead to a well-defined mathematical problem. When you are in the perturbative regime, this is not really a problem. You can start with Hamiltonian, which is not well-defined, but since you treat it to first order in perturbation theory, nothing dramatic happens. But now I would like to treat this Hamiltonian to all order. So I have to check carefully that my model is well-defined mathematically. For example, I should first solve a two-body problem and a three-body problem exactly to check that everything is working fine. So E is a famous example of an ill-defined problem, which is simply an interaction potential given by a Dirac delta distribution in 2D and 3D, where you would assume that the interaction potential V of R1 minus R2 would be a coupling constant multiplied by a delta of R1 minus R2. So why is this ill-defined? Well, let's try to solve a two-body problem with a purely delta potential. So the center of mass motion can be decoupled from the relative motion. And then the two-body Schrödinger's equation in the center of mass frame is simply E psi is equal to minus h bar squared over m Laplacian of psi plus g delta psi, where r is the relative coordinates of the two particles. But now you see that in 3D, psi is a function such that its Laplacian contains a delta. This means that psi contains a 1 over r singularity in 0. Since you know that Laplacian of minus 1 over 4 pi r is a delta. So either psi of 0 is equal to 0, in this case, this term has no effect, and you recover just a non-interacting state vector, or psi of 0 has to be infinite, in which case this writing is meaningless. And you have the same problem in 2D, of course, because in 2D, if a wave function has a Laplacian proportional to delta, it contains a logarithmic singularity at the origin.
But maybe you can remedy the problem if you use the Lyapunov superpotential.
Yes, exactly. You have to regularize. Yes. Mm-hmm. I agree. This is what I will do, basically. So here, just something which might be evident or maybe not. I will be speaking of a wave function psi and Woolly wave function in this talk. What do I mean exactly? So for spinless bosons, psi is just the usual wave function. It has to be totally symmetric. If I'm dealing with fermions, so in this talk, they are necessarily of spin 1/2 fermions, then psi is simply the component of the state vector on a given spin configuration. I will assume that there will be small n particles with spin plus 1/2 and capital N minus small n with spin minus 1/2. And then after this projection on the spin state, I get an Woolly wave function which has to be totally anti-symmetric with respect to the first small n coordinates and also totally anti-symmetric with respect to capital N minus small n other coordinates. Okay. So all this will be implicit from now on. Okay, so what is the first model that comes to mind? It's the Fermi pseudopotential, introduced by Fermi in the context of nuclear physics, I believe. I guess that most of you know actually this model. But still, I will define it. So here, for simplicity, in the case of two particles, so the action of the interaction potential on the state vector is simply 4 pi h bar squared times the scattering length over m multiplied by a delta, multiplied by not psi, but by the regular part of psi, where the regular part of psi is a function of the common coordinates of particle 1 and 2. So you take psi in R1, R2, you multiply by the distance between two particles, and you take the partial derivative with respect to this distance, keeping fixed the center of mass position of the two particles. And now you put this distance R1, 2 to 0. So the two particles, 1 and 2, converge one towards the other with a fixed value of the center of mass position. And then this regular part is a function of this center of mass position, this finite center of mass position. Okay, so the basic assumption, of course, in this regularization is that the wave function psi diverges at most like the 3D Green's function, that is 1 over r. So this is an assumption that you have to check, that psi of r1 rn is everywhere capital O, 1 over R ij, whatever I, for all I different from j. Otherwise, again, this regularization doesn't make any sense. So if this condition is satisfied, the effect of the regularization operator is very simple. It removes simply the 1 over R ij terms, if it exists. And that's all.
Is there an analogous two-dimensional prescription?
Yes.
So the log, you have to divide by the log or something?
Yes, you have to remove the log, yes. Mm-hmm. Absolutely. Yeah.
I've never seen that discussed.
I can give you a reference of a paper where it is discussed. Yes. I will mention it at some stage, yeah. But I will not give the formula home. So this model is very nice. It has several advantages. First, it depends only on the scattering length. This is what you wanted. Also, it's ideal for exact analytical calculations. Why is it so? I would say, for example, for few body calculations like DIMA is doing. So why is it so? Imagine that you have, again, this two-body problem in the center of mass frame. Then you have to solve this Schrödinger equation, Laplacian plus k squared, where h bar squared k squared over m is the energy, okay? Acting on psi is equal to 4 pi a, the regular part of psi, multiplied by u delta. So here, in this case, this is purely a number. Okay. So the general strategy to solve this equation for few bodies is to write the solution of this equation in terms of the Green's function, which is natural because here you have a delta. You know that the Green's function is a solution, a particular solution to this equation with a delta on the right-hand side. So what you write at psi is a general solution of the homogeneous equation, psi 0, plus 4 pi a psi regular multiplied by the Green's function of the 3D Laplacians that I've rewritten here. And once you have this writing, you can close a consistency loop by calculating the regular part of psi, which is simple from this expression because this will be regular. And the regular part of this Green's function is easy to calculate from this expression. And then you get an equation, psi regular is equal to psi zero regular minus I ka psi regular. That is, you started with an equation of a function of three variables, and you are left with an equation of a function of zero variables. So with this procedure, you eliminate three variables, or you eliminate one particle, if you want. So in general, if you have a n-body problem, you can eliminate the center of mass motion, if it is separable. You can eliminate a second particle using this trick. So you are led to a n-2 particle problem. So you can solve a three-body or four-body with no problem. I think five-body is getting more difficult, Dima, no?
I find four-body difficult.
Okay, four-body is already difficult. You have to use an addition of rotational symmetries. So what are the disadvantages of this potential? First, it's not intuitive at all. For example, the two-body bound state appears only for a positive A, that is, for a positive value of the factor in front of the delta. And some people find that not intuitive. What is also not intuitive is that this expression, the integral of minus h bar squared over 2m psi star Laplacian of psi, is not the kinetic energy. In general, in quantum mechanics, it is the kinetic energy. But here it is not, because basically the kinetic energy contains a gradient of psi squared, which is not equivalent to this writing here, because psi has singularities. So this expression can have actually any sign, can be positive or negative. It's a sum of kinetic energy plus interaction energy, and the kinetic energy itself is infinite. An important disadvantage is that the use of this pseudo-potential introduces a modified Hilbert space. It's not the same Hilbert space as the one of non-interacting particles. What you can show is that the Fermi pseudo-potential is equivalent to having three waves, solving the interaction-free Schrödinger equation with contact conditions, with boundary conditions, that when two particles meet, particle I and J meet for fixed values of the center of mass position, the wave function has to behave like that. Some function of the other coordinates of the center of mass position multiplied by 1 over A minus 1 over R IJ plus a little O of 1. So you have to be careful to consider only in your theory, n-body wave functions fulfilling these boundary conditions. Otherwise, you are making simply wrong things. And this makes, of course, variational calculation tricky. For example, for fermions, you cannot use Hartree-Fock theory because the Hartree-Fock state vector does not obey this boundary condition. And the BCS on that does not either. For bosons, you have the same problems. You cannot use Hartree-Fock. You cannot use Hartree-Fock-Bogdanov theory. and you cannot use a just true on that. Actually, at first sight, you would believe that the just true on that, let's take the case of three particles, okay, then the wave function in the case of an infinite scattering length would be simply like 1 over R12, R13, R23. This would be the just true on that. So at first sight, you would say that this satisfies the boundary condition. This is almost true. It satisfies the boundary conditions everywhere, except in the case where the position of particle 3 is equal to the center of mass position of 1 and 2, in which case the just true on that diverges as 1 over R12 cube. Yeah, it has a minus here, I'm missing. So this just true on that, because of its failure on this particular point, cannot be used to do rational calculation. This is annoying. Okay, so here's something more technical that maybe only a few experts will appreciate. Yes?
Well, variational curvature is tricky. Is that because the pseudo potential is not Hermitian?
No. It's tricky, simply because you have to suggest a version on that, which is in the correct Hilbert space, that is, which satisfies the contact conditions.
Yeah.
Your version on that has to be in the domain of the Hamiltonian. Okay. Otherwise, you can predict what you want.
The Hilbert space is restricted. The Hilbert space is restricted because.
It's restricted. Well, yes, it contains wave functions that satisfy these contact conditions. That means that when two particles meet, you should have a divergence, or the wave function should tend to zero, or it should diverge as 1 over Rij. And there should be this link between the divergent term and the next term, the subleading term.
Curvature becomes tricky because variational procedure must always be done subject to that boundary condition.
Yes. But I'm sure we can invent some version on that which obeys these boundary conditions. I have not tried really. But Ludovic Prikupenko, for example, is interested in this idea. Yes. I don't know if this has been done. Yes, so this is a problem which is rarely discussed. What happens in this Fermi pseudo-potential when three particles meet, not just two? What I mean is that I consider the case of particle 1 and 2 converging to their common center of mass position. In the case where this location, the center of mass position, is already occupied by particle 3. What happens in this case? Okay, then what you do in this case is that you use just the general method of integration that I've presented. So you write Schrödinger's equation for the three-body wave function. You integrate it formally using the Laplacian Green's function so that you relate psi actually to the regular part of psi in 1 equals 2, 3, and in 1 equals 3, 2, and in 2 equals 3, 1. So furthermore, you can use the Fermi-Hobbes symmetry so that at the end only the regular part of psi in the case when 1 is equal to 2, 3 is required. And since we are working in center of mass frame, this function is not a function of six coordinates, it's a function of only three, which is the center of mass position of 1 and 2 minus the position of 3. This value called u. So the Fréni regime is when u, R12 minus R3, is equal to 0, what happens in this case. So in the case of fermions, everything is very nice, actually. So you set u is equal to 0. In this general formula giving you psi, then you put R12 to 0, and what you find that psi behaves as minus A over R12 multiplied by the regular part taken in 0, plus a little O of 1. There is a funny compensation that there is no constant term there, whatever the scattering length. So now to close self-consistency loop, you should say that the regular part of this expression is equal to psi reg of 0. But the regular part is 0, because if you remove this term, you don't get any non-zero constant. So you conclude that psi regular of 0 is equal to 0 for fermions. In a way, it's natural, because I've taken fermions of spin 1/2. This means that you cannot have three fermions at the same point. And this appears very smoothly in the formalism. So for bosons, actually, it's more involved. You cannot do simply a local reasoning in U equal to 0. You have to write an equation for psi reg of U, for all values of U. But then from the requirements that psi reg of 0 should be finite, you reach actually the same conclusion. So this was not surprising for fermions, but this might be surprising for bosons. So apparently, in this Fermi model, you can never have three particles at the same point, even for bosons. Otherwise, for bosons, you will have a diverging regular part of psi, which ruins the whole idea. So actually, this calculation was stimulated by your question, Mike. Okay. But now, of course, we would like to solve the n-body problem. And at first sight, it's difficult to solve the n-body problem with the Fermi model. In particular, I don't know how to perform quantum Monte Carlo with the Fermi pseudo potential. Maybe this is possible, but I don't know if there is a procedure. So we set up an alternative. Just we take a discrete delta interaction potential on a lattice. So now the space, the real space, is discretized on a cubic lattice in 3D and a square lattice in 2D. And I call little l the grid spacing along each direction. So we have to construct the Hamiltonian. In the Hamiltonian, basically, you have a kinetic energy term. And you will take a dispersion relation, which is h bar squared k squared over 2m. It's easily constructed in the basis of plane waves on the lattice. The difference with free space is that the wave vector, each wave vector component has a meaning only modulo 2 pi over little l because of the lattice. This means that I can restrict the wave vector k to the fundamental domain D, which is minus pi over l cube. And then on this lattice, the interaction potential will be purely local. It's a discrete delta with a coupling constant G0. So G0 over L cube, connector delta of R1, R2. So here we have basically two parameters, G0, which is a bare coupling constant, and this length L. I don't want to have any L dependence in my results. So what I expect that when I put L to 0, at least when KFL will be much smaller than unity, any L dependence should disappear. And this has to be checked, for example, in an explicit quantum Monte Carlo calculation. So here there's a little detail left, how to choose the coupling constant G0. Well, simply using always the same idea that you have this model potential, which is discrete delta on a grid, and you would like this discrete potential to have the same scattering length as a true interaction potential. So what we have done is very simple. We have calculated the scattering length of the delta potential on the grid. And then we have equated it to A. And this gives you G0 as function of L, the grid spacing, and as function of the scattering length. Basically, this is the result. G0 is equal to G, which is 4 pi h bar squared over m times A, divided by 1 minus a number, 2.442 and so on, A divided by L. Yes, maybe I should skip the details. What we do, we calculate the T-matrix on the grid, exactly. And then from this T-matrix expression, you can calculate the scattering length and adjust it to A. And you get this famous relation that 1 over G0 is equal to 1 over g minus the integral over the domain D of d3k m over h bar squared k squared. So this is very similar to the usual prescription that you find in field theory, for example, used by Ronderia in your BCS series, what you are doing, yes. The difference here is that we have really a lattice. We do that from the start in the Hamiltonian. Yes, interesting point here, maybe a bit technical, but here this is really an integral, even if the system is in a finite size box, okay? Because to calculate the scattering length, there is no box. You should do the calculation in free space. So if you replace this integral by a sum, actually you get wrong predictions when the box size is on the order of A. So what is amusing in this model is that when you put the grid spacing to zero, so as soon as L is much smaller than absolute value of A, this term becomes very small. This term becomes very large, on the contrary. So I can neglect the one there. A cancels out because G is also proportional to A. And you find that G0 is proportional to L, and it's negative. So this shows you that you have attraction, actually, in this model. The discrete delta describes attraction. It's an attractive interaction. Another comment, sometimes people are confused. If you put A is equal to infinity, you see that in this model, you don't get a hard sphere delta on the lattice, but you get something attractive, G0 exactly equal to that. In a way, it's normal that you have a negative G0. Because if G0 was positive, you could never have both positive A's and negative A's in your theory. Yeah. Anyway.
So
do you find this surprising?
I was just going to ask you, if, before you go on to the next slide, could you go back to the previous one just to see?
Yes.
So the interaction potential diverges if you make L very small.
Mm-hmm. Yes, because G0 scales as L, and here you have division by L cube. Yes.
So, are there states?
Fortunately, I would say. Yeah.
Are there states where the particles both inhabit that cell, which go off to infinite energy?
I will come back to this point, yes. Your question, what happens when you have several particles on the same side of the lattice?
You know, in condensed matter things, that bit of the wave function still matters because it gives you super exchange and so on. So, okay, well, but you'll come to describe what.
But in short, for fermions, there is no problem.
There's not that.
With this, well, now I'm just being T-squared over you, how you get that out of this.
It's about single site. You can only get two
fermions. Oh, no, sure. I meant to get the T squared over U nearest neighbor coupling of the spins out. It's whether, if one is too brittle, obviously, by putting U equals infinity, then of course you're going to get. Anyway, you're going to come to that, I'm sure.
No, what I'm going to say is that for fermions, there is no problem because you have at least at most two fermions on the same site. But for bosons, you're right that the spectrum is not bounded from below. Was this your point? No.
No, I
okay.
Guess. if G naught was negative, that would be my point. Yes, but if G naught were positive, then I guess what I was worried about was that the configuration where you have both fermions on that cell or that site, that part of the Hilbert space, even when L is very small, can give you some qualitative effects. For example, it may distinguish between two particles when they scatter whether they want to have their spins parallel or anti-parallel.
So now you're in the case of a positive
G0.
Huh?
Positive G0.
Ah, okay.
Maybe that's irrelevant to what we're going to talk about.
Yes, in my case it's negative. So.
But I guess even if G0 is negative, I wonder whether you get some of the opposite sign then. You may still get some spin-dependent effects. We know.
Well, in a way, there will be spin-dependent effect because two particles of the same spin do not interact, and two particles of opposite spin interact.
You see something for that configuration. Maybe an energy scale you're not interested in because it's too low.
But anyway, what I can say now is that I have no proof of, I mean, mathematical equivalence between model 1 and model 2 for fermions.
Sure.
For bosons, I have proof of non-equivalence, as I will show. But for fermions, I simply believe that there is equivalence, but I have not proved it. Maybe I should. Yeah, so what is nice with the lattice model is that we can use a BCS on that, for example, or any version on that you have in mind, because there is no restriction, difficult restriction on the Hilbert space, just a regular Hilbert space, the same as the one of non-interacting particles. What is nice also is that you can make the link with Hubbard Hamiltonian theory. It's very similar to the Hubbard Hamiltonian. The main difference is, in our case, we like to have a k-squared dispersion, not a cosine k dispersion. Also, what I like is that you see immediately in this model that the coupling constant is negative. So that the ground state energy of the gas has to be negative. For bosons, and that would be less than the Fermi, I mean, the ideal Fermi gas energy for fermions. So we immediately understand that Fermi gas, for example, in the neutral limit, should experience attraction. And this is what they see in the experiments. We'll come back to this point. What is nice also is that this model can be solved with contour Monte Carlo. Since G0 is negative, there is no sign problem. So in principle, we can use a contour Monte Carlo method to solve this problem. A problem of model 2, of this lattice model with bosons, is that you can have three particles on the same side. And then there's a catastrophe in the limit of L tending to 0. And then I think there's actually no equivalence between model 1 and model 2 in the case of bosons. So Dimitrov has reminded us what are the Efimov states. So to make it short, I would say that the lattice model exhibits Efimov states in the limit of L tending to 0 when the scattering length is infinite. On the contrary, Efimov states are not acceptable in the model 1. Because actually, in model 1, if you try to plug in an Efimov state, you find, for example, that the regular part of the wave function, when 1 is equal to 2, tends to infinity, when the location of particle 3 coincides with the center of mass of particle 1 and 2. Or to put it another way, if you look at the behavior of the wave function, the three-body wave function, close to a point like that, where three particles meet, you find a 1 over R12 squared divergence, which is not acceptable in the Fermi model, because this cannot be regularized by the regularization operator. But apart from this non-equivalence with model 1, you remember my first requirement about thermodynamics. In the limit of L tending to 0, I can show very easily that the spectrum of model 2, Hamiltonian, is not bounded from below when you have three particles, three bosons. So what you do, you just take a rational on that, where all the bosons are on the same lattice site. You calculate the mean energy, and you find an upper bound on the ground state energy. This upper bound scales as minus h bar squared over ml squared, and this coefficient, n minus 2.918, is actually positive when n is larger than or equal to 3. Okay. This means that there is no, I mean, the spectrum is not semi-bounded. Actually, I think that Marcus Holtzman and Anna Miguzzi at some stage tried to do a contour Monte Carlo with bosons, with a model slightly different than this one, and they had exactly this problem that the bosons were clustering at the same point. It's not the state you would like to describe. Okay, so that's all for the presentation of the models. So now I will go through a very simple model, which allows to, I would say, locate the various explored experimental regimes. But there is no pretension of this model of being quantitative. So now I consider the case of spin 1 half fermions. And please consider a given fermion of spin up. I will model the effect of the nearest spin down fermion by just a fixed scattering center corresponding to the Fermi pseudo potential. The effect of the other n over 2 minus 1 spin down particles will be just modeled by a box of size rho to the minus 1/3, where rho is the mean density. And I would like also to model the effect of the other n over 2 minus 1 spin up particles, including the fact that I should take into account Fermi statistics. So what I do simply is that I take a box with absorbing boundary condition. That means that the wave function of this spin up fermion should vanish on the border. So what is nice in this very naive model is that you treat in a non-perturbative way the correlations between two neighboring particles. Of course, what you cannot have is a long-range physics. But we know that the short-range correlations, at least, are very important in the regime KFA larger than unity. Yeah. So I have this model. I can calculate an energy epsilon, so an eigenenergy epsilon, for the wave function in this little box. And then I will say, just to say something, that the energy of the gas will be 1 half capital N times epsilon. Basically, because epsilon is the energy of a given spin-up particles, and I have capital N over 2 such spin-up particles. Okay, now I have to choose the radius. I said that the radius of the box was on the order rho to the minus 1/3. Can I be more precise on the coefficient? So I consider the case of a vanishing scattering length. I calculate the energy of the ground mode in the box, which is given by this expression. It's proportional to pi over capital R squared, where R is the box radius. And this should coincide with the energy of the non-interacting gas, which is given by this expression in terms of the Fermi energy. So I get this particular relation that K Fermi R is equal to this number. This is not very important, but it's just to fix the ideas. Okay, now I will solve a one-body problem. So I have to solve this Schrödinger equation in the box with the boundary condition that phi varies as 1 over r minus 1 over a, close to the origin, and vanishes on the border of the box. Okay. Yes, we are all able to do that. For positive energies, phi will be a shifted sign divided by r. And then the energy is h bar squared k squared over m, and k solves this equation. Tangent of kr is equal to ka. So this gives me a, and then it will give you k as function of kfa, because r is related to kf by this formula. One should not forget also the negative energies, where epsilon, the energy, is minus h bar squared kappa squared over m, and then phi is an hyperbolic sign divided by r. And the energy is given by the solution of this implicit equation. Hyperbolic tangent of kappa r is equal to kappa a. So now I've plotted the predictions of this naive model as function of minus 1 over kfa. Just to have a direct mapping with experimental results. On the left of the Feshbach resonance, A is positive, and minus 1 over KFA is negative. Yes, am I affine? Yes. And the right part of this figure will also correspond to the right part of the Feshbach resonance in the experiment where A is negative. So for a given KFA, you get, of course, a discrete spectrum in the model. So this will give rise to an infinite number of branches. Here I've plotted only the first two branches, what I call the ground branch and the first excited branch. So the location of the resonance, that is the unitary quantum limit, A is equal to infinity, corresponds to this zero there. So you see that we find an energy which is below the one, actually it's below the one of the non-interacting Fermi gas, which is given by those limits A tending to 0 minus or 0 plus, but it's also positive. And here I've plotted the pressure as function of minus 1 over KFA, we find that everywhere the pressure is positive, and also the compressibility is positive. So in this naive model, you would say that there is no problem of stability. The Fermi gas is stable, even in the quantum unitary limit. Okay, short discussion about the ground branch. Well, you all know this ground branch. Basically, it connects this regime where A tends to 0 minus, which is a weakly attractive Fermi gas, to this regime where A is positive and you form a condensate of dimers. So it connects a BCS regime, if you want, to the condensate of dimers. Okay. Mm-hmm. Yes, this I said already, that there is stability in this naive model thanks to Fermi pressure, because if you use the same model for bosons, you will conclude that there is instability. You find an effective attraction. Good. And also it gives you the idea of adiabatic following. If there is such a branch connecting BC and BEC and BCS, then you can, by adiabatic following in the experiment, just changing slowly the B field, link one extreme regime to the other. And now, this idea was heavily used in the experiments, as you will see. But what is also interesting in this model is the upper branch, because I think the upper branch did not show up in previous models. In your model, you have only the ground branch. So the upper branch, in a way, for experimentalists, is very natural, at least the beginning of this upper branch. It corresponds to, on the left side, it corresponds to a weakly repulsive Fermi gas. Now, when you get closer to the Feshbach resonance, the gas is more and more subject to repulsion. And here, in this unitary limit, now you get a state of the gas with an energy larger than the one of the ideal Fermi gas. So I would say that this upper branch has not been fully explored yet experimentally. Why? Because what happens is that when they start on this branch and slowly increase the B field, to get close to the Feshbach resonance, at some stage there, they activate three body collisions that will produce a dimer and an atom. This means that this upper branch is not stable, if you want, with respect to three body collisions, and quite rapidly the system falls down to the ground branch, and you produce, I mean, something very boring, just I'm joking, of course. It's a Bose condensate of dimers. But maybe one could find a way to try to explore the branch further this side. I don't know.
Does it matter how rapidly the magnetic field is changed with time?
Could you repeat?
If you change the magnetic rapidly? Field very rapidly, can you...
So you start there, and then very rapidly, took you
yeah,
change it to this value, for example.
But whether it's a problem with how adiabatic you're being, or whether if you go quickly.
Yes, you have to be fast enough, I would say. I don't know the answer to your question. I don't know if they've tried this in an experiment. Yes, I will ask them. Apparently, they have tried with several scan speeds, and more or less it was always decaying. But when they did the experiments, the phenomenology was not very clear yet, as you will see. So
if you try the adiabatic, then you get three-body recoupling.
Yes, adiabatic is not. It's not. But I feel that one should try to explore this branch in more details. Yes. Yeah, so at this stage, I would like to point out that there are two ways of producing a condensate of dimers. Either you start from this branch and slowly ramp the B field to go there. And then you have produced a BC of dimers, but without relying on three-body collisions. You do rely on many-body interactions, but not collisions. And the other way is to start from this branch, and then you activate three-body collisions, and you produce a gas of condensate of dimers. I mean, both techniques have been used in the experiments. Okay, let's just
material. Do we need a breather, or how's the audience's attention span?
I suggest that I present the experimental results, and then we will move to another part. Then we can make a break.
Okay.
Fine. Okay.
Don't hear very much coming from
there. There's our experimental results, so it's not, I mean, it's very relaxing.
That's dangerous.
Okay, to justify the title of my talk, I will present a few experimental results obtained at UNS. So what they've done mainly is to measure the expansion energy of the gas. So they start with a cold gas of fermions with some value of the scattering lengths. Then they switch off the trap abruptly. They let the gas expand. And then from the expansion, they are able to figure out what is the energy, the kinetic energy of this expanding cloud. And then from conservation of energy, they write that the energy of this expanding cloud is equal to the original kinetic energy in the trap plus the interaction energy in the trap. So they have access to this quantity. So what they can do also is to perform a ballistic expansion with a vanishing scattering length. I mean, just before opening the trap, they put the scattering length to zero. Then they open the trap, and then the gas expands as a non-interacting Fermi gas. And in this way, you have access to the momentum distribution of the gas, which is interesting. Yes, they have this experimental trick that they would like to be able to image all the particles, not only atoms, but also the molecules, I mean the dimers. So what they do, they break the dimers just before performing absorption imaging with the laser. So they move the scattering length from positive to negative. This breaks the dimers, and then they put the scattering length to zero and perform imaging. This is an experimental trick. Ah, okay. Yes. I have to rotate it probably here. Okay. yes, I should persist in the. Okay.
Does that mean they can't
image molecules? Your question, is there a way to selectively image atoms and molecules? This is maybe. I think in general this is possible. Yeah. I remember Ketale having done that. Yes, for example, yes.
Mm-hmm. So I guess what they do, isn't it, to excite to some other atomic state by breaking up a molecule and you image that state.
Well, this is different. This is RF Petrovsky. But what, for example, what Ketterly can do, the table in gene also can do, is apply a gradient of the magnetic field. And binding energy depends on the magnetic field. Well, binding energy depends on, scattering length depends on the magnetic field. Binding energy depends on the scattering length. And that means that molecules feel this gradient in different way than the atoms, free atoms. And they fly apart.
Okay, thank you.
Then you have to break molecule and then use absorption.
Yes, but we know how to break them, yes. Okay. Okay, so here is an experimental result. Not very recent, actually, but. So here, this is this release. So from the release energy, actually, they extract what they call the interaction energy, and they divide it by what they call the kinetic energy, and they plot this as function of the magnetic field. The Feshbach resonance, again, being 820. So there are basically two series of points, crosses or squares. So for the crosses, actually, they started with A, small and positive, and they move the B field towards the resonance. So they were happy to see that the interaction energy was going up. Okay, but then at some stage, there was a loss, they say, at the time, loss of particles. And then there was this jump in the interaction energy. It was moving to a negative value. When they started from the other side of the Feshbach resonance, so A negative, not that small actually because of the background scattering length for lithium, they indeed saw that when they were getting closer to the Feshbach resonance, the energy was going down. So that at the resonance, coming from both sides, the conclusion was that the interaction energy was negative. Okay, there's effective attraction. So here there's a mismatch, probably because the number of particles has changed. During these three-body processes, actually, some atoms can be ejected. So the number of particles here is not the same as here or there. And at that time, it was not clear for them that they were actually exploring two branches, not one. So they had a theory, which were trying to link actually the two branches by a single branch. I think that actually Jora is author of this paper, also Savas Kokelman. Okay, but now I think the situation is settled. These states correspond to two branches. Okay.
You mean so the branch shifts from upper branch to lower branch?
This corresponds to a change of branch due to three-body losses, formation of molecules. This is what we believe now, yes.
And do you think this corresponds to your upper branch and the lower branch?
Yes.
Okay.
Exactly. Yeah. Actually, they were not believing that much in that model at that time. But
it's three-body. Three-body processes into big band states, not three-body processes into small ones. Because you still see those.
Yes, but I understood that actually the preferred channel is this large dimer, because it is a much larger expansion, spatial extension than the deeply bound states. So you would expect this three-body recombination rate to scale at some power of A.
Depends on
the sweep rate of the B field.
Yeah, as Mike suggested, if we can sweep idiomatically, then one can follow the upper branch. If that is true, then maybe the sweep of the information is surprising.
You think so?
Well, I guess,
but Mike was suggesting to scan fast, not slow.
Yeah, between going fast and slow.
If it was faster, then maybe that would be no any better chance.
No, it fixed magnetic field when you fix scattering times. The three-body recombination rate constant scale is A to the 6. A to the 6 for positive scattering times. Basically, A to the 4 times KA to the power of 2.
Mm-hmm.
So it varies very rapidly in the other resonance.
Yeah. Basically, A to the 6 is the same as, for example, we define the range of the van der Waals potential, right? Like almost fixed point. Because it's like go from 0 and then minus infinity, basically. So here, this is also the case. A to the 6 is pretty strong.
Yeah, so one has to play some trick, yes.
That explains why this is so abrupt, also the decrease.
I don't think it strongly depends on the speed rate at this point.
Mm-hmm. You're just saying it sets in so fast that however fast you go, you're...
I mean, if you increase scattering length by a factor of 2 to the 6 is a very large number. So here you have like atomic gas, and then you increase A by a factor of 2, you have very fast three-body recombination and you have mixture in India. If I understand correctly, that these points are the mixture of atoms and molecules. Right?
Mm-hmm. Yes. Yes, later on they revisited this procedure. You have 80% of atoms, of molecules, sorry.
It's like chemical equilibrium between atoms and molecules, right? You start with from this upper branch, and then you can solve for temperature and for...
Mm-hmm.
Is it consistent with this point?
Later on, they have, yes, some new data on the expansion energy, and it seems to be consistent, yes, with the model, like you said, where you calculate the temperature under the assumption of isentropy. So you assume that the entropy is constant.
Do you know what is the value of the scattering length at this point in between, you know, around 700 yards? In the middle of this gray region.
No. We can have a look back on a previous, transparency, but I don't know by heart. So.
Should we just dig it out?
You would like to get out? No, no, I have not.
No, I think just to...
Okay, so I will. Recharge, rotation, horaire. Boom. Yes, I would like to present like two slides, three slides. No, okay. You would like to break the break now? Huh?
Well, let's just find this number and then we'll take a break.
Or you would like to find the number now?
Yeah, at least I thought we both have it.
Okay.
But what is the background
schedule?
Was that the one?
This is all I have. Yes. So this is 750. Ah.
100 nanometers. Now, the delta B is like 50 Gauss, and the junior is 100 Gauss. So it's 50 nanometers. 500 nanometers.
Okay, so you're not surprised. Good. Okay. Ah, yes. So at the UNS, they have obtained a Bose concept of dimers. And here you see density profiles after ballistic expansion. Lithium 6, which is fermionic. So the experimental data corresponds to the scattered points. And they perform a fit, I mean a two-component fit, Thomas Fermi plus Gaussian profile. You see that if you take a Gaussian only, you get something like that. So there is no good agreement with the data. But if you take a B-component fit, you have a good agreement. So they extract a condensate part and a non-condensed background. And this is the same result, but now with bosonic lithium. Yeah, you see clearly the peak is narrower than in the case of condensate of dimers. And now from the ballistic expansions of a quasi-pure condensate of molecules, I can extract the scattering lengths of two molecules. So I can measure this ratio, scattering lengths of two molecules divided by the scattering lengths of two atoms. And I find this is 0.56 plus 0.3 minus 0.2. And this is compatible with the prediction of Dima Petrov and Jura Shapnikov, which is 0.6, based on this four-body calculation with the Fermi pseudo-potential. And as you know, of course, other groups have obtained a common set of dimers, DBG with potassium-40, Rudi Grimm with lithium-6, and Keterle with lithium-6. Yes, now to basically the last experimental results there's a point which is particularly interesting, I would say, which is the unitary limit where the scattering length is equal to infinity. When B is equal to B0, you are right on the Feshbach resonance. In this case, if you believe that you can model the interaction potential by a contact potential, there is no parameter left because the scattering length is infinite. This means that at a given temperature, actually, the thermodynamic functions will depend only on T over TF when expressed in terms of the Fermi energy. So in particular, at zero temperature, you expect that the ground state energy of this gas would be some number, numerical number, eta, multiplied by the ground state energy of the ideal Fermi gas. So if I use model 2, and if I take as a version on that just R3 Fock, I find that this eta is less than 1, effective attraction. If I take the more refined BCS wave function, perform a variational calculation, and this was done by Randeria in 97, I think, you find that eta is less than 0.5906. And now, if you do a fixed node Green's function, Monte Carlo wave function, a Monte Carlo calculation with a trial Jastrow BCS wave function, this means that the nodes are fixed and coincide with the nodes of the BCS wave function. So as done by Pandari-Pandey, you find eta is equal to 0.44, plus or minus 0.01. And what I understand actually is that this eta is also an upper bound. It's not necessarily the exact value, because you fix the node of the wave function, so you do not explore the full functional space. So how do the experiments compare to that? So here I've plotted eta. This line corresponds to the BCS version of Landsat, 0.59. And this is the more precise upper bound by Pandari-Pandey, 0.44. The first measurements were performed actually by John Thomas. This is in his science paper, the paper where he reports stability of the Fermi gas in the unitary limit. Actually, he finds a value which is very close to the ideal Fermi gas case. In a later paper, he has another estimate, which is 0.75. But this is, for example, larger than the BCS prediction, which is worrying, actually.
At the bottom here is what, time and years, or
what? yeah, more or less, yes. This is chronological order, yes, for the experimental results. yes. So I think what happened that he did measurements in for a B field, which was 910 Gauss, quite far away from the Feshbach resonance. Because now the location is known from Ketterer's measurements, 820. And then there was a measurement by Rudy Grimm at B equal to 850 Gauss, so closer to the Feshbach resonance, which is now consistent with the rigorous upper bounds. And Christophe Salomon also very recently has made a measurement at 120 Gauss, and he also finds something which is below Pandari-Pandey's results. So now the race is open, how to calculate this value, the most precisely possible. Yeah. So just to finish about the experiments, I mentioned this idea of performing adiabatic following on the ground branch. So now, to be more specific, I would like to discuss how the temperature evolves in this adiabatic following. So imagine that you prepare a condensate of dimers. So you have a Bose condensate, and we know that evaporative cooling is working very well. Okay, so you produce a very cold Bose condensate of dimers at initial temperature Ti with n particles with scattering length Ai. And now you will very slowly move the B field so that you scan the Feshbach resonance. And you will move to the part where A is negative. And the question is, what is the temperature of the gas? I will call it TF, final temperature, corresponding to the final scattering length AF. So what I will assume is that the scan of the Feshbach resonance is slow enough for thermal equilibrium to apply at any time so that the entropy is constant. Yes. This was checked recently by Rudy Grimm. He scanned both ways, from left to right, from right to left, and he found almost the same temperature as the initial one, so very small heating.
You mean the three-body recombination doesn't give rise to any difference?
Three-body recombination?
Lower branch.
Yes, it's the lower branch, yes.
The right.
Yes. Now I'm on the lower branch. So what we can do easily is to calculate these entropies in emitting cases. Imagine that on the left of the resonance, you have a condensate of dimers, and you can treat these dimers as bosons, weakly interacting bosons, and the temperature is well below the critical temperature for BEC, and well below the binding energy of a dimer, so that you don't have atoms, I mean unbounded atoms flying around. In this case, you will find that the entropy scales as T cube, provided that the temperature is larger than a fraction of the chemical potential actually. The other limiting case on the right side of the resonance is when you have a weakly interacting Fermi gas, not paired, not beset state, just a normal state. In this case, the entropy will scale as T, where T is the temperature. So we will find by equating the entropies that the final temperature of the Fermi gas is equal to the initial temperature cube. This means that, for example, if you reduce the initial temperature of the Bose condensate by a factor of 2, by playing with cooling tricks, you will gain a factor 8 on the final temperature of fermions. So here we have plotted the final temperature of the fermions in units of Fermi temperature as function of the inverse initial temperature of the Bose condensate of dimers. And you see that you can explore quite easily a range of final temperature between 1 over 20 and 1 over 100 Fermi temperatures. So maybe this technique can be used actually to reach really the BCS regime, that is to observe a condensate of pairs in a regime where KFA is on the order of unity or less than unity. Here I've plotted actually the corresponding critical value of KFA to get a BCS state. You see that they are below 1. So the BCS theory is roughly applicable. OK, so that's all for the experimental part. So now we make a break.
Yeah, I think we should get some fresh air and cover something or the other.
And then I will present you some results. I mean, the exact time-independent solution for the n-body problem in the unitary limit.
So what you say?
Strict 10 minutes.
Should I switch off this or no? A little bit like that?
Yeah, we can switch it off for the moment.
Switch it off now.
You don't want to have some fresh air?
Oh, maybe it's easy.
I will have some fresh water. Oh, it won't, you can't get rid of the damage.
No, you can't get rid of the rocks.
What's that?
This was my first experience.
How is it? How is it managing?
It's a little tough.
The older boys, it's fine.
Unfortunately, Americans and American schools are very unaccustomed to dealing with people who don't speak English.
Well, not easy.
Sometimes you gotta work on English and Spanish.
Okay, well.
Okay, so last part of this talk. We will study a little bit more detailed the ballistic expansion of the gas. Why? Because I do that all the time in experiments. Typically, they prepare the gas, for example, in a steady state. Then they switch off the trapping potential abruptly. They let the gas expand for a few tenths of milliseconds. And then they send a laser beam and perform absorption imaging of the expanded cloud. And they get from that a signal, which is a function of two coordinates, x and y, on a camera, which is proportional to the integrated density along z at time t. And really, it's a very useful procedure because, in a way, it acts as a magnification lens. For example, Jean Delibar used this technique to reveal the presence of a vortex lattice in a rotating Bose-Einstein condensate, because the vortex cores were actually too small in situ to be seen. But after expansion, you could see the cores. So is it really a faithful magnifying lens? Yes, if you are able theoretically to relate the expanded density to some observable in the trap. And in general, this problem is non-trivial because there are particular interactions between the ballistic expansion. It's not just an ideal gas expansion. But there is a nice case where you can actually really consider this expansion as a magnifying lens. It's when you have a scaling solution. What I call a scaling solution is a relation like that between the density of particles at time t and the initial density of particles in the trap. You have some scaling factors, lambda 1, lambda 2, lambda 3, for each direction of space, which depend on time, so that rho at time t is simply the rescaled rho 0 with the three rescaling parameters.
What are the conditions on this scaling? For, when you do the same experiment and you measure momentum distribution instead of, you know, this magnified density.
So when they measure the momentum distribution, what they do is that they put the scattering length to zero, okay, just before the expansion. And in this case, the expansion is trivial.
It's always done.
No, this is not always done. I think this is. Well, they want to measure the momentum distribution, but they don't do that very frequently, you know. I think the only group doing that is Salomon with fermions. I've not heard about other groups doing that. But they can, but usually they don't. So it simply performs the ballistic expansion in presence of the interactions between the particles. But so in the case you mentioned, when put A equal to zero, in this case, yes, it's trivial, of course.
Oh,
the scaling solution exists only in particular cases, unfortunately, not in all cases. And precisely, I'm making just a brief history of scaling solutions. The simplest scaling solution is probably the case of a non-interacting gas expanding from an harmonic potential. I don't know who has realized that the first, but this exists not only in quantum mechanics, but also in classical physics. And you have exactly a scaling solution relating the final density to the initial density. Okay. Another famous example is a scaling solution for the Boltzmann equation of a classical gas in a harmonic isotropic potential. there exists such a scaling solution, which predicts in particular that if you change abruptly the trapping frequency in this isotropic trap, you will excite a breathing mode that will never be damped according to Boltzmann's theory. And this solution was known to Boltzmann already. And then at the time of experiments on BECs came several scaling solutions for the Gross-Peterski equation. So weakly interacting Bose condensate, a pure Bose condensate, in a harmonic trap. So first, if you are in the Thomas Fermi regime, you can make some approximation to the Gross-Peterski equation, dropping the quantum pressure term in the hydrodynamic representation, and then you find a scaling solution. So this was done in particular by Shlepnikov and Yuri Kagan, and Ralf Doom, and myself. And sorry? Ah, yes, okay. Every time I'm missing a note, yes. So if the system is in Thomas Fermi regime and your trap is rotating, actually you can generalize this scaling solution to this case. This was done by Maxim Olshany and Pipastory in 2000. Also, now if you have a purely 2D system, so Gross-Peterski equation for a 2D condensate in an isotropic harmonic trap, then you get a scaling solution not only in the Thomas Fermi regime, but in all possible regimes, from the weakly interacting regime to the Thomas Fermi regime, as realized by Shlepnikov and Kagan
and
Surkov in 1996. Isotropic in 2D, it means that omega x is equal to omega y.
Oh, okay. But the third direction is?
This is in 2D. Isotropic in 2D. Huh? So
okay.
Okay. You mean isotropic is only in 3D? Huh?
Well, is that what you?
Okay. Now, if you, let's let it more general than Gross-Peterski equation, if you use the hydrodynamic equation for a superfluid, then you know that the essential ingredient of this type of equations is the equation of state of the system. That is the connection between the chemical potential and the density. So when the chemical potential is proportional to the density to some power, rho to some power gamma, then again you have a scaling solution. And this was realized in particular by Stringari and Menotti in 2002. So this is quite general, it applies to bosons and fermions. In the weakly interacting regime, but also in the strongly interacting regime. For example, in the unitary limit, you see you can apply this scaling theory, because in this case, mu is indeed proportional to rho to the power 2/3.
Is that scaling solution only for the density?
So in the hydrodynamic theory, you have an explicit expression for the density and the velocity field. So the density is just rescaled, and the velocity field varies linearly with position. Or if you prefer, the phase of the order parameter varies quadratically.
Is there a situation where you can have a scaling solution for the quantum field?
For the quantum field, okay. Let's move to the...
Stringer and Menotti solution is for a uniform case or harmonic trap
case? No, harmonic trap. Yes. Sorry, this is for harmonic trap. Not necessarily isotropic, but the trap has to be harmonic, yes. So now if you try to move to the n-body problem...
It would also work for any power law trap?
Harmonic trap is very special.
Yes. Because you see, as I said, the phase, for example, of the other parameter varies quadratically in this and that. So now if the trap is not harmonic,
That's just homologous expansion, right? Everything's stretching by a scale factor in the three directions, maybe different factors.
No, that's true. Then the phase is quadratic if everything stretches. And the dynamic phase is like rho squared. And
yes.
If rho squared, that should cancel the parabolic confinement, not rho to the power of 3.
So I tried to list a few examples of scaling solutions for the n-body problem now, for a quantum field, as you say. Well, there's a trivial example. If you take 1D gas of impenetrable bosons in a harmonic trap, then you have a scaling solution. This comes from the fact that you can have an exact mapping of this bosonic problem to a non-interacting Fermi gas. And then for the non-interacting Fermi gas, you know that there is a scaling solution. This is known to Girardot, for example. Yes. Godin also might know it. I don't know. So now if we move to 2D, so you have an n-body Schrödinger equation in 2D with an isotropic harmonic trap, okay, omega x equal to omega y at all times, and you take an interaction potential which is either 1 over r12 squared or a delta. Then there is a scaling solution. This is Pitayevsky and Roche, 97. But of course, here the problem, as I said at the beginning of my talk, that a delta interaction potential is meaningless in 2D. It's very nice, but meaningless, in the sense that it's very nice because delta of R12 over lambda is equal to lambda squared delta of R12. So if you use this type of property, you can prove the existence of a scaling solution. But this is only formal. Okay, because since the delta is not regularized, you don't know exactly what you are doing. So now if you regularize the delta, you will see that, as done by Olsheny and Prikupenko in 2002, you will see that the regularization actually breaks the scaling invariance. You might know that this regularization actually in 2D is equivalent to imposing boundary conditions on the n-body particle functions to have a logarithmic divergence like that, log of R12 over A, a small rule of 1. One R12 tends to 0. And you see that there's a scale, I mean, there's a length appearing in this problem. If you rescale R12 by a factor lambda, your wave function will no longer satisfy this boundary condition. So what I believe is that Pitayevsky results, actually, Pitayevsky's results applies only to states with no particles at same point. That is to wave functions and body wave functions such that psi is equal to 0 when Ri is equal to Rj, whatever I different from J. And there's a famous example of such a state in 2D, which is just the Laughlin state. The Laughlin state has this property, and then the scaling solution of Pitayevsky and Roche will apply to it.
But at that point, the interaction potential is irrelevant anyway, so you might as well, you get the same answer without the interaction potential, even
then. Yes, it should be the same scaling as the ideal gas. Yes. Yes, yes. Yeah.
Well, but in some sense, it is an ideal gas, isn't it? Because there are no particles are not overlapping.
The Laughlin state is an eigenstate of an ideal gas, yes?
Yeah.
So. Yes, yeah, okay. Mm-hmm. If you restrict to this type of state, yes. Sure.
So in all of these examples, so special rule is played by the harmonic trap. So this may suggest that an interpretation of John Dalibor's experiment, latest experiment of quantum potential, might be due to some experimental mechanism.
Well, this I don't know. I have not investigated this problem. But,
I mean, we were checking the values of the lambda that he puts in. The dimensionless admixture rate is about 10 to 1%.
0.001.
If you depending on 0.002, depending on how you define the coefficient, but it's very small. So I mean, they make a statement that they assume that it doesn't change, but nobody's actually examined it. But you might guess. If the admixture is so small that there should be some kind of continuous shift in the behavior proportional to the coupling constant, but I don't think it's been examined.
Not by me. Yeah.
Or it might only affect things at large times,
right,
or something.
Right.
Okay, now I will present a scaling solution for the 3D unitary quantum gas. This solution will be restricted to the case of a harmonic potential, which is isotropic. Okay, and it's also restricted to the unitary quantum gas. It means that the scattering length has to be infinite. So what happens in this case? The n-body problem over the domain where the, all the position, the particular 2x2 instinct is simply the free Schrödinger equation. So IH bar divided by psi is equal to a sum of Laplacian terms and trapping potential terms, where this trap frequency can be in general time dependent, but the trap is at any time isotropic. Okay. Plus, of course, you have to add contact conditions that the wave function psi has to behave like some capital A over R ij plus little o of 1 when particle I and j tend one towards the other. So when you have a finite scattering length, here you would have a minus 1 over A term, but here A is infinite, so this term is 0. So this defines a unitary quantum gas. For the initial state, I will take just an n-body stationary state in the static trap of frequency omega 0. And I will call E the energy of this state. So let me point out that, of course, I am not able, in general, to calculate this stationary state that I will call psi 0. But what I'm able to do is to relate psi at time t to psi 0 using a scaling transform. Okay, so here is the ansatz of the scaling transform, which will look very familiar to, people used in scaling to this business. So the n-body wave function will be a phase e to the minus I theta of t divided by the scaling parameter lambda to the power of 3n over 2 multiplied by exponential of I times the mass times lambda dot over lambda, 2h bar, and the sum of our, since you multiply the wave function by some phase, and this phase here has a quadratic dependence on the coordinates. So now you have to check two things. You have to check that this ansatz preserves the contact conditions so that it's in the right Hilbert space, and you have to check that it solves the free Schrödinger equation over the domain where two particles don't meet. So the scaling condition, the scaling transform actually preserves the contact condition. This is rather clear, I would say, because if you replace Rij by Rij over lambda, what you do simply that in this expression, you will multiply this function A by lambda. But that's all, and no constant term will appear here. Okay, this guy will remain small o of little o of one. Okay, you agree? That if I perform a scaling of the coordinates, I don't change the contact condition. This is true, of course, if I perform an isotropic scaling. If I would perform a scaling which is not isotropic, respect to x, y, z, then this guy will not transform by a multiplicative factor. The next point is to check that the gauge transform also preserves the contact conditions. So what we do, we isolate two particles, I and j. The other ones have fixed positions. Then what appears here is ri squared plus rj squared. And this I can rewrite using the relative coordinates and the center of mass coordinates. So I find 2 capital Rij squared plus 1 half Rij squared. So this is just a constant in the process Rij tending to 0. And this will vary. So now if I insert this in the exponential, I can expand the exponential to first order in this term. I get something which is 1. Plus a constant multiplied by Rij squared. So the 1 is fine, it's a constant factor. What happens with the Rij squared? It's fine also, because you see this Rij squared will multiply this term, and it will turn it into a little o of 1, because this scales as 1 over Rij, so if I multiply by a square, I get something proportional to Rij, which tends to 0. Good. So the next step is to adjust, the lambda, the time independence of lambda, so that this will solve Schrödinger equation on the domain where two particles don't meet. And this is, of course, simple, and you find the same scaling as the ideal gas, lambda double dot is equal to omega 0 squared over lambda cube minus omega squared t multiplied by lambda, with initial conditions that lambda is equal to 1 and lambda dot is equal to 0 at time 0. And we have some expression for the phase, this phase theta, which is this integral of 1 over lambda squared multiplied by the energy. So by the way, if you don't perturb the system at all, lambda remains equal to 1 at all times. And then you see that this phase theta is simply E times the time, t. Okay. So that's it. We have this exact solution, which applies, again, only in the unitary limit for an isotropic trapping potential. And this scaling solution has amusing consequences. First, there is a phenomenology that was already predicted by Pitayevsky and Roche. Imagine that you perform a perturbation of the system. You slightly change the trap frequency. You will excite a mode, and in linear response theory, you will linearize this equation for lambda, for the scaling parameter, to find the frequency of this mode. And you find that this frequency is 2 omega 0. And this mode also is undamped. So you predict the presence of this undamped mode of frequency 2 omega 0. Also, you predict the existence of a lowering operator. Call it L minus. It's defined here. If you act L minus on the initial state vector psi 0, you will get either 0 or an eigenstate of the Hamiltonian with energy E minus 2 h bar omega 0. This means that actually there is a nice structure in the n-body spectrum. Each level has a neighbor with an energy separation which is 2 h bar omega 0. And you can construct explicitly a lowering operator which allows you to go down in the spectrum. Another consequence of this scaling.
There's
also a raising operator, yes. I have not written it. You have to change the sign, maybe this sign here.
Okay. Well, the bit that isn't an emission is the bit that looks a bit like a virion, no?
Yes, yes, yes. This is why this next point is virial theorem. And actually, Frédéric Chevy, who is an experimentalist, has found independently a more direct demonstration of virial theorem just using a rescaling of the state. But here what you do is that if you take this expression, you multiply by psi 0 and integrate, you will find this relation that the total energy for any eigenstate of this n-body problem is exactly equal to twice the harmonic energy. This means if you want that interaction energy plus kinetic energy is equal to harmonic energy. But also a very nice consequence of that is that the energy is actually always positive because the harmonic energy is positive. So by studying just a ballistic expansion by a detour, you reach the conclusion that your problem has a spectrum which is semi-bounded. So you conclude that within this model, there is stability of the Fermi gas.
Yeah, but it will also work for bosons, right?
It will also work for bosons, absolutely.
Yeah. Well, it will be stable.
Yes, but this was a question of Mike, right? So this is what in my talk, I try to be clear that if you use the Fermi pseudo potential, you don't have the FEM of states. Okay? Okay, in this case, there is no paradox, I would say. Because again, the FEM of states will not diverge as 1 over r when three particles meet. They would diverge as 1 over r squared. So they are not acceptable.
Do you say that you can show explicitly and strictly that the Fermi gas, the ground state, well, the energy of the ground state is positive?
Yes. This is what I claim, yes. Within the Fermi model, of course, yes. But now, if you believe that model 2 is equivalent to model 1, I have also this result for model 2, that the energy is positive in a harmonic trap. Yes, I'm making this very strong statement.
Isotropic.
Isotropic. Yes, actually, the demonstration of Frédéric Chevy is more general than that. And you don't need really isotropy. You need only harmonicity. Okay. So
is
now.
It special to two species of fermion?
No, actually, this proof, I mean, doesn't depend on the statistics. It applies for bosons, fermions, distinguishable particles.
But for spin three house fermions, you might worry about the Efimov business again.
Sure. Yes. But if you want, what happens that in the Fermi pseudo potential business, you don't have the Efimov states. Okay. I think this result is mainly interesting for spin one half fermions.
I mean, somehow okay. There is an underlying assumption, isn't there, that all the intrinsic physics is two body, which is sort of built in for the starting point. And if there was anything beyond that, it might contaminate it somehow. And the contamination may come from short distances, like with Efimov, or it might be something more subtle than that. I
agree with you. If you have only two component Fermi gas and the mass of one component is several times higher than the mass of the other component, then they might be like bound four body or six body state.
Yeah, the masses are equal. Okay. Yes. I've not. What happens is the masses are different. So. Maybe it works. Yes, actually, yes, this is true. Yeah.
And, well, for example, the threshold for the Efimov state is 13 point something, mass ratio. And I believe that if you calculate like four body bound states or six body bound states, then this threshold will decrease. I'm not sure, but I think maybe.
Sure. But my point that if you use the Fermi model, you will not get the states as acceptable n-body states.
Yes. Yeah, so what you say is that this positive energy comes from this model and from the fact that you exclude the Efimov state, right?
I would say the Fermi pseudo potential exclude them. I would say yes, because if you accept the Efimov state, again you will get a 1 over R12 squared divergence for Psi.
I think you excluded it by assuming there was no reflection of short distance physics left in the problem. Because I think the Efimov states require another length scale to come into their logarithms and things, which isn't in your description. So,
sure.
So that within your starting point, if it's correct, I think everything follows, but it's just there may be, for the bosons, so there's the issue about Efimov, and for fermions, there might be more subtle things going on. You know, large N body band states starting to appear or something, but if one says one can neglect that, then.
To summarize, I would say that using model 1 have a lower bound, and using model 2 have an upper bound. Now, okay, if the two models are equivalent for spin half fermions, I think this is fine. Yes. But your point that I should prove this equivalence. This is.
Yeah, I guess so. And even for spin half, I worry about whether things can happen at large n, but that's a worry. It's not anything more tangible than that. It's a bit like what you were saying that maybe. As you make the masses closer and closer, Efimov runs off to a large n-body band state rather than being small numbers. Somehow you can exploit this 1 over r squared and the probability density of the two-body wave function to build some bigger band state at very large distances and a large number of particles, but it's only a worry rather than anything more tangible.
Okay, I will conclude basically. What I can say now is that if you take an isotropic trap, then the hydrodynamic prediction of Stringer-Minotti, I mean the scaling transform, of course, agrees with the exact solution. This hydrodynamic theory, of course, can be used also if you have a non-isotropic trap. In this case, you can compare two experiments. And I would say that for the moment, there is no agreement with experiments. For example, at the ONS, they've seen that the ballistic expansion, when the gas is just with infinite scattering lengths, is not well reproduced by the scaling solution of hydrodynamics. Maybe because in the experiments, the gas is not at zero temperature, so there is a normal fraction, and you cannot use simply superfluid hydrodynamics. But there is a discrepancy. Okay. So thank you.
Okay, well, thank you very much. So you've given us lots of things to think about, talk about. So what exactly do they see in the experiment? How does it deviate from the hydrodynamics?
Okay, they get some asymmetry of the cloud after the expansion, but this asymmetry is not the one you would expect from quantum hydrodynamics, from hydrodynamics. I think they get an asymmetry which is smaller than the expected one.
So they start with cigar-shaped clouds, and they get like something like that.
It's not very cigar-shaped, actually. In the ONS, the aspect ratio is, it's order unity. I don't remember the exact frequencies, but it's not a very strong cigar shape geometry.
It's cylindrical.
Sorry?
It's cylindrical.
Really? I'm not totally sure, actually, because they're using an optical trap obtained maybe by crossing laser beams. So I don't think it is even cylindrical. Of course, I asked them if they could do something isotropic. They know it's difficult because of this geometry of two laser beams. And as you know also, in Rudy Grimm's experiments, the frequency of some brazing mode doesn't match exactly the hydrodynamic prediction in the unitary limit. So I think there are evidences of non-hydrodynamic behavior in those experiments. In the quantum unitary regime, of course.
When you say to calm the vortices, are you thinking that, for example, maybe something strange happens in the core of the vortices in the unitary limit?
I think experimentalists will try to produce vortices, to produce a vortex lattice. In a Fermi gas.
Oh, okay, no, I thought maybe you were meaning particularly in the unitary limit that something.
Yes, in particular in the unitary limit, yes.
Yeah. What the core size depends on the unitary limit?
There's not a scale.
Yeah, so.
Well, yeah, you could get parallel of behavior.
Constant times the inner particle space. Yeah. It could be a large or small constant times the inner particle space.
Or it could be you get parallels and something funny might happen, which I thought maybe was what you were alluding to.
No, it's to come. I have no precise ideas, just to indicate possible directions. I'm trying to guess what will happen next. Yeah. Okay,
should
we stop here? Thank you.